It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Republicans in the state legislature have released a set of bills that would limit safety net benefits like unemployment. We'll hear from one of the lawmakers behind that package and someone who's studied unemployment over the course of the pandemic. First, a data analysis by the nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum found that alcohol-induced deaths in the state rose 25% in 2020. That was the biggest one-year increase in the data since at least 1999, and it follows similar trends seen nationally. And it comes on top of steady increases over the last 20 years. Alcohol-induced deaths are defined by biological causes that stem from drinking, like liver disease or alcohol poisoning. That number doesn't include indirect causes, including drunk driving crashes. We're learning more about what that data showed and what we could do about it, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen people in your life drinking more since the start of the pandemic? More often, higher quantities, or both? Do you blame pandemic stress? Do you see a drinking culture, an alcohol culture, being a problem here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mark Sommerhauser is the Communications Director and Policy Researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
And Ari Brown is Senior Research Associate for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Ari, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on.
Mark, sometimes it can be tough to grapple with things that come out as data points. Can you give us a sense of the significance of this 25% jump in alcohol-induced deaths over the course of 1 year?
Well, yeah, it's clearly a significant increase. I think you mentioned in the intro the largest single-year increase that we could find in the data going back more than two decades. So certainly something that, you know, within a pretty significant period of time was the largest one-year increase. As I think was also mentioned in the intro, this was not a new direction for the trend line to be moving in. Prior to 2020, we had seen alcohol-induced deaths in Wisconsin and nationally on the rise. But this is definitely the largest jump that we've seen within the course of a single year. And we thought that was something that we wanted to highlight in this report.
Ari, do we know why alcohol deaths had been trending upward even before the pandemic?
Yeah, this is such a great question, and one that I think we're really still searching for, you know, complete answers for. You know, one of the things that we kind of looked at a couple months ago was, so on the policy side, we're able to look at revenues from alcohol taxes in the state as kind of a proxy for how much alcohol is being consumed, or, you know, what those kind of changes look like year over year. And 2020 really represented kind of an anomaly in that data. The spike was quite high in 2020. But you're right, we noticed that basically in every year, you know, since 2000, the rate of alcohol-induced deaths in Wisconsin has been rising. And while 2020 was kind of the biggest spike, as Mark mentioned, this trend has been on the increase. One of the other things that I think it's important to point out as well is that, you know, the alcohol-induced death rate in Wisconsin largely tracked that of the national rate for the first kind of decade of the 21st century. And really only since 2010, 2011 or so has it started to really tick up. And I think we haven't really found great answers as to why that has been happening. You know, some items that have been mentioned include just kind of expanding the overall availability of alcohol. You know, we talked to experts who, you know, mentioned things like the fact that, you know, liquor licenses are largely given out at the local level in Wisconsin. And with over 1,800 municipal governments in Wisconsin, it can be kind of hard to know what is going on behind the scenes there. But yeah, I think it's really something that we're still searching for answers for.
Mark, Ari just mentioned our numbers had kind of separated from national numbers before the pandemic. How did we compare to the nationwide jump last year? I know drinking didn't just go up in Wisconsin, but how did we stack up compared to national numbers?
Yeah, so the increase that we saw here in Wisconsin, just the single year increase, I think, as you had mentioned, about 25%, that was actually very close to the national 1 year increase from 2019 to 2020, which was also nationally was actually just slightly above 25%, but very, very close to what we saw here in Wisconsin. I do think, though, it's important to kind of zoom out a bit here and understand that kind of over the long term, especially over the last decade, You know, there has been this national trend of increasing alcohol-induced deaths, but Wisconsin's rate of these deaths exceeds the nation significantly. And it also, over the last decade, has increased more rapidly than it has nationally. So there's an element here of Wisconsin being part of something that's happening nationally, but there's also an element of Wisconsin sort of exceeding the pace at which that national trend is unfolding.
Ari, something that struck me looking at your charts, and I think I'm reading this right, a big separation for Black people in Wisconsin versus Black people nationally when it comes to these alcohol-induced deaths. And it hasn't always been that way. Can you tell us what we've seen?
Yeah, this was one of the things that I think really stood out to us as well. So when you look at the nationwide picture, right around 2000, you have the rate of alcohol-induced deaths for Black Americans dip below that of white Americans, and it has remained below since, and is now there's a pretty big gap between those two groups at the national level. In Wisconsin, those trends were also happening around 2005. The rate for Black Wisconsinites dipped below that of white Wisconsinites. But right around 2011, 2012 or so, you started to see the rate for Black Wisconsinites start to really increase in a way that the national rate was not. And then in 2019, you actually had the rate for Black Wisconsinites go above that of white Wisconsinites, which is completely counter to what's happening at the national level. So that was one thing that really stood out in our data. You know, we noticed that for all of the other racial and ethnic groups that are included in the CDC's data set, the rate of death from alcohol-induced causes looks very similar for each individual racial and ethnic group in Wisconsin compared to the nationwide levels, except for Black Wisconsinites, where it looks completely different.
Talking to Ari Brown and Mark Sommerhauser from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, looking at a new report on alcohol-related deaths in Wisconsin, alcohol-caused deaths in Wisconsin. Numbers went up over the last 20 years. Numbers jumped up 25% in the first year of the pandemic. Let's get to some policy ideas. Mark, in this report, you and your colleagues started to look at policy options out there. What kind of things did you see on the table?
Yeah, so we're our a nonpartisan organization, and we don't, you know, advocate for specific policy measures. But sometimes in a report such as this one, we will say, here are a few options that policymakers could consider, not by any means an exhaustive list, but, you know, certainly some options that could be considered are looking at either reducing, you know, the availability and the access to alcohol in our state, increasing alcohol taxes, which has been shown across the population to reduce the overall amount of alcohol that is consumed within a large population if taxation on alcohol is higher. You know, that said, we recognize some of the political hurdles that would be associated with that if policymakers were to go that direction. So, you know, another sort of possibility that we put forward in the report that we feel like potentially might get a little broader, you know, buy-in from different sides of the political aisle might be to look at, you know, putting more resources toward things like alcohol abuse prevention, intervention, treatment for alcohol abuse and addiction. These are things that obviously are not partisan and you know, we feel like potentially might be able to get a broader buy-in from policymakers across the spectrum.
And Ari, with the research you've done using these national numbers to see what's going on here in Wisconsin, would we be able to measure the impact of the policy changes Mark just mentioned, should they be implemented?
Yeah, I think it's such a great question. And I think it's one that, you know, those who are kind of in the academic space and the policymaking space are always interested in exploring. I think you need to do kind of a lot of more intensive studies. And it's hard to just say, you know, this one state has high alcohol taxes and a low rate of alcohol-induced deaths. Therefore, that's what's causing it. You know, kind of the old adage that correlation does not equal causation. But it's definitely, you know, worth a shot if you're concerned about this issue. And there are definitely, you know, policymakers out there that are interested in this topic. But yeah, it would require a lot more kind of intensive study to draw direct links between any individual policy and what was going on with the alcohol-induced death rate.
We'll leave it there for now. Ari, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And Mark, thanks for being with us.
We appreciate you having us on.
That's Mark Sommerhauser and Ari Brown with the Wisconsin Policy Forum with us today, sharing their recent data analysis showing a significant increase in alcohol-induced deaths here in Wisconsin. Up next, we'll talk to a doctor and public health expert for a look at what we could do to try and reduce the problem. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think alcohol deaths have been going up in Wisconsin over the last 20 years, jumping in the first year of the pandemic? Do you blame Wisconsin's drinking culture in part or something else? Are there policy changes you'd like to see, things that might work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation on alcohol-related deaths in Wisconsin, turning our attention now to how we can reduce those numbers. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we drink too much here in Wisconsin? What would you do to change that if you think we need to do anything? If you moved here from out of state, were you surprised by the amount of drinking that happens here in the state? We hear that sometimes. Do you have a policy solution you'd like to see to try to get people to drink less in the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Patrick Remington is an emeritus professor at the UW-Madison Department of Population Health Sciences. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
We just heard that report from the Policy Forum about an increase in alcohol-related deaths. And to start, Dr. Remington, this was focusing on direct alcohol cause, liver failure and things like that. I imagine alcohol has a much wider footprint when you throw in alcohol-related traffic incidents or alcohol related to suicide and things like that. Can you talk about the wider impact that excess drinking can have?
Yeah, there's no question that alcohol has a broader impact. This report was really well done. By the way, I think the Wisconsin Policy Forum should be congratulated. In a time of misinformation and science denial that we see in the newspapers nearly every day, they did solid research, good evidence on the trends in these causes of death. So it's really good to begin with solid research and solid science. And the trends probably would be reflected in looking at alcohol-related falls, for example, or motor vehicle crashes. But getting back to their main finding, mm-hmm. There's been a long-term trend of alcohol-related deaths. These are serious causes of death. About 1,000 people now are dying each year in Wisconsin, largely preventable because these are related to alcohol misuse, and probably up to another 1,000 other causes where it's not a direct cause, but a contributing cause.
How do we define excessive drinking to a level that can lead to these alcohol-induced deaths?
Well, again, it depends on the disease outcome. For many of these diseases, for example, cirrhosis or pancreatitis or chronic conditions, that comes from a long-term rate of high alcohol use and misuse. And it seems by their data to occur in the mid-life period, middle-aged people. But on the other end of the spectrum, binge drinking, drinking and driving, that can happen acutely, or alcohol poisoning. So there are these quick effects related to injuries or poisonings. But this report focuses mostly on the long-term chronic effects of excessive alcohol use, and including alcoholism. That's included in the definition of alcohol-induced deaths.
Can you give us a sense of how much drinking is involved in that kind of long-term excessive drinking that we're talking about?
Well, this is they have standard definitions that the CDC uses. Typically, what's called chronic heavy or heavier drinking is more than 2 drinks a day or 14 drinks in a week. But again, that varies by individual. Depends on the type of alcohol and the pattern of consumption. But we think of problem drinking in 2 areas. One is heavy drinking, long-term heavy drinking. And again, for some people, that could be as little as 1 drink a day. But then there's the binge drinking, the drinking that happens in acute episodes. And that's related more to acute problems and injuries.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW-Madison Department of Population Health Sciences, looking at a new report on showing an increase in alcohol-induced deaths in Wisconsin, going up over 20 years, big jump in the first pandemic year. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Sarah is with us in Madison. Sarah, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Sarah?
I just want to say I think it would help if we could just legalize marijuana.
You think that would be an alternative to drinking for some people, Sarah?
I do. I think a lot of people, if that was legal, they would do that instead of drinking.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Dr. Remington, what do you think of that idea?
Well, it's a great hypothesis. In fact, we have natural experiments ongoing in this country. It'd be a hard thing to test that in a laboratory. It's really a population-wide or a sort of a real question. But we have states that have legalized marijuana. And I know colleagues in Colorado who are studying the long-term trends, the theory being that whereas alcohol use increases the risk of a cirrhosis and pancreatitis, long-term marijuana use doesn't. It might increase the risk of respiratory problems, but again, the hypothesis is that this states which legalize marijuana may see declines in people who are abusing alcohol, but they'll also see rises in some of the unintended consequences of marijuana use. So it's a good question, and many people have posed that. In fact, there's been an argument for legalizing marijuana because we know the long-term effects of alcohol, and we know that alcohol cannot be illegal. That experiment was tried almost 100 years ago and failed. So we need to have alcohol accessible, certainly legal, but we'd like to reduce the harmful effects of alcohol in the population.
Sarah, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jenny in Elkhorn. Jenny, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say I have lived in a subdivision where we would get together all the time and have get-togethers where we drink and everyone is in their 30s and 40s. And I actually got divorced because of excessive drinking. I was drinking too much, and therefore, you know, I wanted my husband to drink less, and he was not willing. But then I had a friend die from that friend group because of pancreatitis, because of this drinking habit. But we would do it socially, but then you get to the point where you can't be social unless you're drinking. And so it's like this vicious cycle. And if there were programs for parents, like, you know, middle-aged, whether you're a parent or not, but we tend to hang out together, programs that weren't so like AA, you know, like more acceptable programs for people to go to that weren't so looked down upon or like embarrassing for you to say like, oh, I'm going to AA tonight. Or provide alternatives for people to be social without drinking excessively.
Jenny, thank you so much for sharing that story. Sorry for the loss of your friend and of your marriage related to drinking. Dr. Remington, first, the central role of drinking in so much of our socializing, I'll limit the borders here in Wisconsin.
Well, I think Jenny's comments are heartfelt and extremely important. What she brings up is so important in this state, well, in the nation, that it is part of our culture. But how do you recognize at the point at which drinking becomes a problem? And she did it so eloquently. I would hope that we would have a healthcare system that could have a conversation with patients about alcohol use, that it's routine, that it's part of screening, and that it's not either you're a non-problem social drinker or an alcoholic. We know that's a spectrum. And early on, evidence shows that a physician conversation with a patient who's beginning to drink more than might be good for their health, that early conversation is called brief advice. Just that brief counseling when people are drinking perhaps two drinks a day, that doesn't seem like a problem, but that could lead to problems. And so I think she made a compelling case for having, I think policy approaches like increasing taxes and reducing access certainly can happen at a population level, but we need a healthcare system where people feel safe, where they can have that conversation. In fact, it should be a routine part of healthcare that people are asked that sensitive issue. And so that early on, before it leads to death or divorce, that physicians and your healthcare team can get involved long before alcoholism becomes a diagnosis and a problem. So it's a really important comment that she made. And I hope that, you know, policymakers don't only look at sort of population-wide strategies, but we think about each patient and what the healthcare system can do.
Thanks for that call. Dr. Remington, just in our last minute or so, we saw this jump during the pandemic. Do you have some thoughts on pandemic-related stress and isolation and its link to drinking?
Well, first, the pandemic exacerbated a long-term trend. We did a study in 2017 and published it in the American Journal of Public Health called The Epidemic of Despair in America. We've had 20 years of despair where people are hurting, either in rural areas or urban areas. People are resorting to alcohol oftentimes as a treatment for underlying problems. So we do have to address the alcohol problem. That can be done in healthcare and through policy approaches. But let's get back to understanding why people seek opioids or alcohol or self-inflicted injuries to solve that epidemic of despair. And I think that's a longer conversation to understand the upstream or the real reasons why alcohol is really a symptom of a problem, in addition to a problem in and of itself.
Dr. Remington, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington, Emeritus Professor at the UW-Madison Department of Population Health Sciences. He's with us today looking at ways we can prevent alcohol-related deaths, which have been on the rise here in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, the president of the state Senate joins the show for a look at a new set of bills that would tighten access to safety net benefits here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new research shows that enrollment at the nation's community colleges is down about 15% over the last 2 years. We'll look at what's going on and what it means for the education and career prospects for those who would typically attend those schools in Wisconsin and around the country. Now, Republicans in the state legislature are out with a new set of bills they say will help with a shortage of workers in the state. The bills would change the rules on some safety net programs like unemployment and Medicaid. Some Democrats and advocates say the restrictions aren't the right approach. We're taking a closer look at the legislation with one of the Republican lawmakers behind that package of bills. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you rely on unemployment compensation, especially during the pandemic? If so, what do you think about the idea of tying the amount of benefits available to the state's unemployment rate? Are you a business owner who's had trouble hiring workers? Do you want to see changes in some of these safety net programs that might help you out? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Senator Chris Capping is the state Senate president. He's a Republican representing Wisconsin's 33rd state Senate district, which covers much of Waukesha County. Senator Capping, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Can you talk about what led you and your colleagues to tackle this series of safety net related issues right now?
It's really been a lot of constituent contacts. It's been personal experience out there where there's very few people who have gone out and not, you know, 2 days ago, I went to get a couple of parts for my lawnmower for the snowblower, and I went up to the door, and there was a sign that said, "Sorry, we're closed because we can't find workers." There's restaurants that are limiting their hours. There's a Cousins by us that actually shut down on the weekends because they said we can't find people to work. Yet we see this crazy phenomenon where we've got we were looking at the medical assistant and the food share numbers, and we've got those are skyrocketing. We've got medical assistants up 40%. And when we looked into it, We found that there's a significant number of checks and balances that typically are in place, but because of COVID and some of the changes in the temporary laws, the integrity of the programs are no longer being checked. So, for instance, if you go out and you have a job interview and you simply just skip the interview, or if you have a person who – we actually had a person in my district talk to me, talk to us about this. They had the opportunity to go full-time with their employer, and they said, you know what, I'm on benefits right now, and I don't have to get off of them, so I'm just going to stay on them, and they turn down the work. So those are the type of situations where we said we have to do something about the integrity of these programs, because very few people feel that fraudulent activity should be digging into the pot of money that has been set aside as a safety net for individuals who do need it. We want to make sure that people who are on the program actually need this to get them, you know, through their hard time.
I want to look at some of the specifics now. One of the bills that you actually co-sponsored would prohibit single adults from turning down a job to remain on Medicaid, that situation you just outlined. Can you talk about what would change and how it might be enforced?
So what would happen is this individual that we spoke with in this situation, they could go from part-time to a full-time. And if they turn down that job, which they did, so it basically will be an increase in employment, but it's the same thing. If you're not working, you're able to work, and you just simply choose not to accept the interview or the job opening, then there's a mechanism that the Department of Workforce Development would essentially create an option for most likely an employer to say, hey, I offer this person a position. We know that they're on unemployment insurance, and that's not what that program is for. If they can't work, that's a different situation. That's not what unemployment insurance is for. So that's really how that would function. It would just ensure that if somebody's getting unemployment benefits, it's because they can't find a job, not because they're choosing not to take a job.
With that situation with Medicaid, could there be some kind of solution that would say, hey, we're not going to, you're not risking your health care to get a better job? We can, I don't know, a sliding scale or something like that?
We actually have that in place already. So that's what BadgerCare is. And so as, let's say, somebody moves from half-time to three-quarter time, their paycheck's going to increase. And what we did years ago as part of BadgerCare was say, let's create a step program so that instead of just having the benefit cliff, which is kind of what you're alluding to, where all of a sudden you just lose all your benefits, you actually gradually transition off of government subsidy onto you paying part of the premium. So it's actually a graduated scale. As your income goes up, the amount that you pay goes up and the amount the government pay goes down. So we have a program in place at all levels to ensure that takes place.
Another bill in the package would tie the length of unemployment benefits available to the state's current unemployment rate. Can you talk about that change?
Yeah, that's something that I actually proposed a couple sessions ago. It's a situation where some other states already have this in place, but when we're looking at how can we better connect workers with the jobs that are available, these states saw significant declines in the people who were on unemployment and increases in people who moved into the workforce, back into the workforce, when they reduced the number of weeks that are available based on how much unemployment or where the unemployment rate is. The easy way to say that is if there are more jobs available to the workforce, then there's going to be fewer weeks that you can be on the unemployment system. And that it really helps just connect the workers with the jobs that are out there.
Another issue we saw, of course, in the early stretch of the pandemic in particular, was a lot of delays in the state's unemployment compensation system. Another bill in the package you all are calling the unemployment system tune-up. Can you tell us what that would do?
Yes. Yeah, that actually... we expand the call center hours, so people who do have unemployment insurance needs, we want to make sure that they can get in so that they can get the benefits that the program has setting aside for them. We put in additional training for employers. Hey, here's how you can use the system. If you're going to be laying somebody off, here's some resources you can give that person so they know how to get in. We want to increase the audits of the work search. So right now, what the program had was you were supposed to be doing work searches because, again, these are not people who can't work. These are people who can work. They just, for some reason, lost their job. So we want to make sure that the work searches are still being done. And then what we did, too, is we said, hey, one of the problems that we had with the crazy increase in claims was we didn't have enough personnel. So we actually would allow the Department of Administration, which is probably the largest organization within state government, they can actually move employees into the Department of Workforce Development to assist with those claims. So they've got more flexibility in, hey, we have an increased demand and need. Let's make sure we've got the employees to handle that internally so we don't have people waiting over a year to get their benefits.
Talking to State Senator Chris Kapinga about a series of proposed changes to unemployment compensation and some Medicaid rules in Wisconsin as employers say they're having a hard time finding people to work for them. Senator Kapinga, stepping back from some of the specifics, can you talk about your philosophy of what a safety net program should look like and how it should function?
Yeah, it actually stems from me growing up. So I grew up on a farm, and we were extremely poor. We had some very hard years. And I remember my parents going on to government assistance for a period of time. And I remember seeing that and the feeling that went with it. I was just like, I don't want to have this in my life. And I was able to step in and engage in the workforce. I think I started my first job when I was 10 years old. And, you know, we were very poor. So I was buying my own clothes at 12 years old. That's kind of the background of my drive to help people engage in purpose. And that you find that through engaging in what you're good at. Everybody's gifted at something. Let's help connect them with that so they can be independent of this government program that, you know, frankly, I've never met a person who's on a government program that says, oh, I love being in this situation. I don't want people to have to be in those situations. So that's why I've been working on this for 10 years on reforming our system to help connect people with available jobs.
And just our last half a minute or so, what's the timeline on this package?
Well, we just finalized it probably towards the end of the year. We were working on, hey, what is going to be in and out of this package? There were a lot of things proposed. So we finalized the package. Now the package is released. We have authors for the bills, and it's going into the co-sponsorship phase where the other legislators can look at it, and it'll start going through committee process. So the different committees will hear the bills. The public will have a chance to come in and express concerns, express support, and then if it passes out of committee, then we would bring it to the floor of the legislature in both houses. If it passes that, then the governor would have a chance at signing these into law, and we can start fixing some of the issues we have.
Senator Kapinga, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Senator Chris Kapinga is the president of the state Senate, a Republican representing Wisconsin's 33rd Senate district in Waukesha County. Up next, we'll hear from a researcher on safety net programs. That's coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our look at proposals that would limit some safety net benefits here in Wisconsin. Republican sponsors say the bills would help with the state's worker shortage. Some Democrats say the bills take access to those benefits in the wrong direction. Andrew Stettner is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, a progressive think tank focused on economic, racial, and gender equity. I talked to him earlier today. Can you take us back to the early days of the pandemic and talk about the scale of need there was for help for people who are unemployed during the pandemic?
Well, it's very unprecedented, you know, what we saw. One out of four Americans ended up needing an unemployment check because of the scale of the immediate closures and all the ripple effects through the service sector, especially tourism, restaurants. You know, there were tens of millions of Americans who lost their job. And because of unemployment benefits, we actually were able to stop any increase in poverty in 2020. That's how effective this system was with the combination of state benefits and federal assistance.
Now, we still have the pandemic going on, of course, but those unemployment numbers have dropped a lot. Is this an okay time to dial back some of the extended benefits, the extended length of benefits that we had had? I know some have been dialed back already. Can we get back to normal now with our unemployment system?
You know, the extensions of federal benefits and the special benefits for those who lost work because of the pandemic, you know, they started winding down of Labor Day of last year. And I think there is some regret that those benefits are not available. You know, there are obviously many individuals who have to quit a job, you know, this year because, you know, they had to take a 2-week quarantine and their employer says, you know, you don't have any time off. And so it's unfortunate that we don't have these benefits. And we have to remember, you know, that unemployment is a difficult thing, you know, in all times. Especially when you lose a job permanently, people need time to look for the right job. We know still in this economy that there are many jobs that aren't really good out there. So you'll need time to find the right job for their skills and experience and to support their family.
We hear, though, about businesses having trouble finding enough workers, particular sectors, raising wages to bring in more workers. Isn't this the time to dial back on unemployment numbers when there, at least on paper, seems to be a lot of opportunity out there?
You know, where the state that we're at, you know, right now with the unemployment benefit program, you know, in Wisconsin and states across the country, you know, the unemployment check covers less than half of your average paycheck. And no one wants to be on unemployment. But people, when they lose a job, they need that time to look for work and find the right job. And actually having a decent unemployment system helps people find a job. You know, if you're in a situation where you don't have any income support, it actually can be really hard to find work. Who's going to watch your kids? How are you going to put gas in the car? So having some cushion helps you go between jobs. But in this situation, I think we're already there. You know, benefits, you know, only last 26 weeks. They're less than half of your average paycheck. People know that there's no future in that, and they're going to return to work as quickly as we want. You know, we've gone to a situation when there were people complaining about these worker shortages when there were 16, 15 million people on unemployment benefits, and now when there are 2 million people on unemployment benefits, they're still blaming unemployment benefits. Something else is going on. The older Americans, you know, anxious about going back to work, lower immigration. You know, there's a lot of other factors going on right now with these employers struggling to find workers and also haven't been able to get away with it for a really long time. You know, you compare what people used to get, you know, we were talking before from walking into a factory or walking into a mine compared to what they do from walking into a Taco Bell or McDonald's. You know, the conditions are terrible. There's no job security, no benefits. And employers have been getting away with that for a long time. They're going to have to start raising their wages because I think after the pandemic, people don't really want to put up with that anymore.
We're talking to Andrew Stettner, senior fellow at the Century Foundation, about unemployment benefits at this stage in the pandemic. Andrew, do you think there are policies that could remove some hurdles, some obstacles that might prevent people from seeking a job, from finding a good job for them?
Well, I think that we need to be much more active than we've been. You know, I think and I've looked at what a number of governors have done. I saw a big announcement from the governor about how they're going to help connect people to jobs. And, you know, I dug into it and it was all just a bunch of websites. You know, honestly, people need sometimes more than just tell you to go to a website. You need a counselor to talk to them. What are your skills? Where do you want to go? If that job that you had before is no longer there, where are you going to go? If you don't want to go back into retail, what do you want to do? What am I hearing as a job counselor from employers about what they need? Maybe you could go work in construction. Maybe you could work as a machinist, even though you never thought about it. Maybe you should go to some retraining. We've left people out of their own, and I think there's still a lot of people that are bewildered you know, and confused. So I would say be more active. We call them active labor market policies. Get people, especially as the pandemic is hopefully easing, get them into job clubs, counseling sessions. I don't think we're doing enough in that area to connect workers to businesses. And this is very relevant for our older workers. Even at a time of job shortage, you know, an employer might say, well, you know, this guy's 57 years old. Is he going to be able to hack it? 62 years old, is he going to hack it? there's a lot of discrimination against older workers. When you have an agency that's in there and talking to the employers, and no, I've talked to this guy, I think he can really do it. Maybe you could try him out for 3 weeks. So I think being more active also with our employers to make sure that they're not discriminating, have ideas in their mind about who can do what job.
One thing on the table in the state legislature here in Wisconsin is an idea that, okay, if unemployment numbers go up above a certain level to a high level, great, extended benefits kick in. When it comes back down to a lower level, we'll go back to our normal timeline of benefits. What do you think of that kind of, I guess you might call it a counter-cyclical approach to unemployment benefits?
You know, what I've seen from some of the proposals that actually would cut back, you know, beyond the basic 26-week package of benefits. And that would be a pretty shocking move for the state of Wisconsin. You know, this program was born in Wisconsin. The first unemployment benefit program was, in fact, the Wisconsin plan. And the idea that temporary unemployment is a menace to society if people experience poverty and hardship after years of working. We should not cut back beyond the 26 weeks of benefits. That's the minimum amount that we should have in all economic conditions. You know, I had a Southern labor leader tell me once, you know, the unemployment rate is not 5%. If you're the one who's laid off, it's 100%. If you're the one who's working at 0%, you know, so if you, especially if you lose is a good job paying with benefits, a company, as they do all the time, moves their production, you know, to overseas, you know, that's a big change for you. So that basic 26-week of benefits should be inviolate. You know, proposals and federal laws, they already only provide those additional weeks, 13 weeks of benefits, you know, for example, or 26 weeks as we had during the pandemic. They only provide those when there's a period of high unemployment. But that 26 weeks should not be scaled back. That's the basic promise that people have. And people work for 10, 15 years, they get laid off, and they say, well, I can't even get 26 weeks of benefits. You know, that doesn't seem, you know, right, especially for how little employers pay in, you know, for the program.
Another proposed change involves people who are receiving health coverage via Medicaid, BadgerCare here in Wisconsin. The change would say, hey, if you're doing that, this is mostly applying to single people here. If you're doing that, if you refuse a higher paying job or a pay increase, because you're worried that that's going to put you over the threshold for that healthcare coverage, we're still going to kick you off of that coverage. I'm guessing you're not wild about that idea, but is there something we could do to not penalize that person who's getting coverage for taking a higher paying job? Is there some sort of like graduated approach we could do?
You know, I think part of the issue is that, you know, there's some limitations, you know, that, you know, in our approach, you know, you have Medicaid, you know, benefits, which are generous. You know, maybe compared to what people can get from their employers or from the health exchange, we should not have health benefits, you know, the quality of them be so contingent and have these benefits cliffs. One thing we can do to help people is, you know, say, well, you can stay on BadgerCare for another, you know, 6 months, even if you go over the limit, you know, so give people maybe we call them a slide down rather than a cliff. We see that in childcare benefits. But the real thing is we should have healthcare, you know, really available for everyone who needs it on an affordable basis. That was in the Build Back Better Act that has not passed yet, which would basically cover all the costs for those middle income workers who have to go through the healthcare exchange and make it more similar to what people get in Medicaid.
As we wrap up, Andrew, is there a lesson that you're hoping we take at the state level, say, when it comes to unemployment that we might have learned from the pandemic?
I hope we learn how important it is. How important the unemployment program is to keeping people whole economically. Look at the forest for the trees. You know, the economy has bounced back faster than any forecaster believed it would. And families have money to spend, so much money that even prices for things like used cars has gone up. That's a success. So let's not cut back a system that really did everything we could have asked it to do.
Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. We really appreciate the time.
That was my conversation with Andrew Stettner, senior fellow at the progressive think tank, the Century Foundation. I talked to him earlier today about some of the Republican proposals to limit safety net benefits like unemployment in Wisconsin. Earlier, we talked to Republican State Senate President Chris Kapinga about his perspective on that legislation. He's a sponsor of one of a package of bills related to those topics. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, pandemic-related supply chain issues still make shopping unpredictable. When are things going to clear up? Join in with your questions and experiences. You can get started right now. If you've had trouble finding a product in stock, the product you wanted in particular, are you seeing empty store shelves or are things going pretty smoothly in your shopping or in your workplace, your business, if you have one? Email ideas@wpr.org to share your thoughts for that conversation. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. The Badger will stay in Wisconsin. It seems like a natural, but it wasn't a sure thing. The Badger in question is the metal Badger sculpture that's been in the state capitol outside the governor's office since 1989. As reported by the Associated Press, the sculpture is made from melted down cannons captured during the Spanish-American War. It rode on the USS Wisconsin during World War I, and it's been on loan from the U.S. Naval Academy Museum since the late 1980s. But as we've talked about on the show before, the museum said they wanted it back. Some leading Wisconsin political types made the case that the Badger belongs in the Badger State. And as of this week, we have a deal. The loan has been extended for another 50 years. We'll check back in on the status of the Badger in 2072. In the meantime, you can check it out on your next visit to the state capitol. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.